Save on quality sofas, sectionals, top brand mattresses, and more during Haverty's President's Day sale. Find the style of furniture you've been looking for at Haverty's, online or in Columbus at Polaris.
The number one resolution for people last year was to save more money, but nearly half gave up by February. Don't let that be you. Download Rocket Money to reach your financial goals this year. Track your spending, cut waste, and automate savings in one simple app. Rocket Money shows you all your expenses and categorizes them so you know exactly where your money's going and where you're overspending. From there, the app cuts waste by canceling your unused subscriptions and lowering your bills. No customer service needed. With that money freed up, the app will automatically set some cash aside for your goals. Whether it's an emergency fund, paying off debt, or saving for vacation, Rocket Money's got you covered. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. And on average, users can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Make saving money a priority this year. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
All right, guys, so welcome to the Goodish Girls. My name is Dallas. This is episode 2 of our fantastic segment, Indie Talk, where we are bringing 3 wonderful indie authors onto our platform today to showcase their books and talk about what their life is as an indie author, because there's a lot behind it that we don't know. So today I have some wonderful authors. I have Christopher Shimone, I have Rebecca Parcha, and I have Katie Stark with us today. So welcome, everybody. Thank you for coming onto our show. I'm so excited to have you guys here. This is amazing. I want to dive right into it. I want to tell all of our listeners and show all of our listeners what your wonderful books are about. So Christopher, tell me about your beautiful book right here. We have Maximus, The Key to Heaven. Before you tell me though, I do have a question, and tell me if I'm saying this wrong. Is it a seraphic or seraphic novel? What is that and what does that mean?
Seraphic. A seraphim is an angelic being. That's what seraphim means. So seraphic is just a hint at saying like, hey, this is a universe of where angels exist.
Okay, interesting. I love that. And then, so tell me a little bit about your book and how is it different than other like fantasy romantasy books that are out there today?
So my book is about this college freshman named Cecilia White. She's this book loving black belt foodie art history major who's just trying to survive
like her
first semester with her best friend and music major roommate Yvette. We're going to call her Evie. It starts off as a normal college life, classes, open mic nights, post-workout breakfasts. Like, she finally feels like she's getting a handle on things. And then she's taking risks. She's getting fake IDs, making friends. This is what college is about, right? And then she starts getting these visions. She finds out this ancient relic called an angel key, something her father gave her, basically dragged her into a celestial war she had no idea existed. And of course, you know, all this chaos starts right after she meets Christoph Maximus, this mysterious club and restaurant owner who seems way too good to be true. And once Cecilia realizes this relic is literally the key to the pearly gates, she ends up stuck in the middle of like a war where love, loyalty, and who she chooses to trust could trigger the end of both heaven and earth.
Amazing. That so is good.
I feel like it's a homage to the early 2000s. I'm bringing back angels and demons. I'm bringing back Nephilim. I'm trying to you know, get that jump start where Cassandra Clare is queen.
That is incredible. Yeah, what an interesting story. We're going to get into it later about like writing like male characters versus writing female characters. So I am interested to see your point of view on that. So Rebecca, tell me about Fangs of Fate.
Yeah.
Look at this cover. That is stunning.
Thank you. Did you see the eyes on it too?
I did.
Yeah, she has like... depending on the angle you do, the eyes will like pop out.
Hold on, I'm realizing this in the moment. No, I didn't know that.
They will pop out or they will like disappear.
Okay, so we have eyes and then if you don't...
I need that.
Wow.
Isn't that cool?
That's amazing.
It took me a while to figure... Yeah, I was so excited about this.
I don't think I ever in my life could create that. There's no way.
Painted wings or something like that. I can send you the info later. They're the ones who actually did the design and then I did all the formatting on vellum. So Fangs of Fate is the first book in the Yuntish series. It's going to be a series of 4 books total. The second book came out in May, Daughter of Destiny, and the third book is slated for next summer. It starts off, so it is a dual point of view and it is first person point of view. So I had a lot of fun writing it. I wanted to tell a story in a bit of a different manner, but still capture what we know and love about romanticy. And so Tate Erlin is our FMC of the series. She kind of is like this badass vigilante, crosses over to the human realm, and kind of like that's where she feasts and that's where she thrives. But in the vampire realm, she's more of like the prey. Like she has one leg shorter than the other. She is considered just like bottom tier as far as like their system goes. And so it does have a little bit more of that urban element to it, but it is very much fantasy still. Like you get the monsters, you get the beasts, you get the dragons, the sword fighting, like all of that fun stuff that we love, but it's also modernized a little bit where you get like these like discs and projections and, you know, more modern weapons and that kind of thing as well. So it starts off with Tate. Again, she is like that vigilante. She's kind of doing her thing. And then as things progress, she ends up finding herself forced to enlist into the Gara, which is like their vampire military for one of the four vamps. And a vamp is like a vampire kingdom. And so she is like forced into this and she doesn't want to. She's also forced into close proximity with Marty, and he's a vampire unlike any other, like never met anybody like this before. And as it goes on, she's forced to confront quite a few truths about herself that she never really knew or wanted to acknowledge. Realizes who she actually is, what she actually is, her capabilities. We get introduced to the dragon shifters that are a big star in book two with the embassy. And then also, of course, it is a dual point of view. So Chance Dale has the other point of view in the story. And he and Tate used to be love interests. But as like time went on, there was a tragedy that happened. He kind of betrayed her. And so she can't stand him now. He's also the vampire president's son. And so there's a lot of pressure on him to feel like he can live up to the expectations set forth by his dad. And he's forever a disappointment. And then he's tasked with ousting a mole and hunting dark magic that's starting to thrive within the vamp again. And so as his journey goes on, you get to see the other half of the story. So you get to see Tate. And it's really kind of cool because you get an up close look at each of these characters. And like, it is first person again. So I love that you get to see their streams of consciousness. I love that you get to know what they're saying, but it's also fun because you don't see the whole picture, so you only see it from one of their points of view or the other. So it's really fun. It weaves together. There's a point and a purpose to it. A lot of people, when they read book two, they're like, that's why she did it this way. And I'm like, yes, I promise there's a reason. So that's a little bit about the series. It's got all the goods: vampires, dragons, enemies to lovers, and a lot of intrigue, and it's very plot driven.
That is wow. I'm hooked. Yeah, all the things that I love. Yes, all of the things, like, in one little beautiful bundle. That is amazing. And then when did you see one more time that your next book is coming out? This summer, correct?
Yes, right now it's slated for August. We haven't made the official announcement yet. I think that announcement is coming end of December or January, but it's looking like August of next year. Yes.
Yay.
So exciting. Yeah, and the audiobook comes out in March, so super exciting there, too.
That's incredible. Wow. All right, Miss KD. Where Darkness Blooms, Greek mythology, yes?
Yes, that's right.
Greek mythology is a special place in my heart. So tell us about your wonderful book with like this very like classy cover too. I'm obsessed with that.
Thank you. So Where Darkness Blooms is a Greek mythology retelling, and it kind of entwines two different myths. So you have the myth of Persephone, and Hades. So that's this incredibly evocative myth about the lord of the underworld, you know, coming up and essentially abducting the goddess of spring and taking her to the underworld, and she becomes, you know, queen there. So that's kind of what's happening in the divine realm between Olympus and the underworld. And then kind of running alongside that in a secondary plotline is the story of Helen of Troy. So she's actually Helen of Sparta. She's the queen of Sparta. And she's abducted, as a lot of people remember from the movie Troy, she's taken or abducted by Paris of Troy. And then, of course, her husband and all the armies of everybody come and they to Troy, and they fight the Trojan War for her return. And so it becomes this huge bloody conflict that ultimately the gods choose sides. So you know nothing good's going to happen when that happens, but the gods choose sides. And of course, all the people who are dying in Troy, you've got all these epic heroes, Achilles, Odysseus, all these folks are fighting in Troy, and all the people who are dying there are going to the underworld. And so Persephone is seeing just this incredible carnage that she's never seen before, because she's had this relatively sheltered life as goddess of spring. You know, goddess of spring isn't involved in major conflict. And so it's just about her grappling with that and sort of rising into her own power. And it's written from a close third. We would call it a close third. And so it's third point of view. It's multi-point of view. So it follows various characters. And so what that means is it's not really omniscient, where it's just like you only see the action and none of kind of what's going on. Close third is where, you know, you're following Hades, but you also get some of his stream of conscious. So it's what he feels. A good example would be Throne of Glass. Throne of Glass is written from a close third POV. Yes. So it's a very similar writing style where you're the story's kind of braiding together in different pieces, and then it all in, you know, hopefully entwines nicely at the end, or at least that's been the feedback, is that it all comes together at the end. So, but yeah, it's just this epic sweeping mythology retelling, and it was so fun getting to take some license where the stories, the original myths, are kind of silent on certain points. And so I had a blast writing it.
That's incredible. And then so this is book one. When is our next book coming out, or is this a standalone?
Sure. So I've been just kind of affectionately calling on book one and book two. But I think, honestly, the further I get into the process, the more they're starting to feel like standalones, interconnected standalones. So yeah. I'm still calling it book two just because that's what I'm calling it. And I'm not going to reveal the title for a little while. But so book two, that would be sort of the continuation of the story after this. I just finished editing it yesterday. So yeah, hallelujah. And then it's going to beta readers and my literary agent on Monday for them to take a look at. So the hope with book two is that it'll go on submission to publishing houses. But of course, nobody, you know, I don't know how that'll work out. I'm new to that whole process, and it's a world I haven't stepped into yet. So
right.
I don't have an ETA or a publication date on book two, other than just I hope it's sooner rather than later, of course. But we'll see.
That's incredible. I'm glad that you're still like pushing and trying, because you never know. Mm-hmm. You just need one person to take a chance. You just need one person to read it and see it for what it needs, like its potential and what it could be. And then that's like it all goes from there.
Mm-hmm. That's so right.
That's incredible. Right. You three have amazing sounding books. I cannot wait to dive into these. So speaking of, you said beta reader, I want to talk about today because I feel like the process of like ARC reading and beta reading and things like that can be super overwhelming, not necessarily from like the reader perspective, right? Even when I started to become an ARC reader, I was like, what does this mean? What do I do? Where do I post? What, you know, what is the author looking for me? What if I don't like the book? Do I post anyway? So I want from your guys' perspective and your opinion on what is a beta reader versus an ARC reader, first of all, and what are your expectations from ARC readers, and how can they read your books, right? How can they sign up for these upcoming books that you guys have as well? So Rebecca, I want to start with you on that.
Yeah. So for the first part of the question, I think for me, at least when I think of a beta reader, I'm very selective with this particular reader. It's usually somebody I trust, a couple of different people, my PA, that type of thing. And I'm mostly looking for their overall impression, like, hey, this part made sense, this plot was great, or this really didn't seem developed enough, or this seemed like a big hole to me, or I really didn't connect with that. I'm looking to know, like, how it lands, you know, like, does it have the impact I want it to have? Is it conveying what I'm wanting it to convey? Is it flowing the way I intend or not? That's what I'm looking for with beta. It's more of that overall, like, picture. It's like, last chance before I send it to full editing. What can I change? What do I need to change? And then with ARC readers, to me, they get the final product. So they get it after it's been through pretty much all of the editing, all of the proofreading, everything, at least for like the first round. So that's not to say sometimes there aren't edits that occur later, but for the majority of it, it's the final product. And they get it before it's released. And so what I look for them is just for them to enjoy the story. And I would love for them to share what their thoughts are on it. And reviews are so huge to indie authors. And so that's mostly what I'm looking for, is like, help me build the hype, enjoy the story, step inside the story with me. I have had a few who are like, hey, Rebecca, I noticed this typo. And it's great when they catch it early too, because then I'm able to fix it before it actually goes to like full print. But that's kind of the difference between the two for me, at least. And then if anybody is interested in joining my ARC team, I have the link. It's on my website, but it's also like on any of my social media platforms. You can just click on my link tree and it's like right there as an option. I'm always looking for ARC readers. I'm actually going to start opening up the ALC, so audio advanced listener copies for the audiobook too. So if anybody's interested, yes, we have that coming up for Fangs of Eight, and it is a full cast. So you get the dark and the steamy and all the
good. Hello, I'm interested.
Nice.
Yes. I would like to, I volunteer as tribute.
Yeah, I'll take it. I love it.
We're big audiobook girlies over here.
Okay, yes. That's amazing.
So KD, I want to bounce it back to you quick, and then we'll head over to Christopher. So what is a beta reader for you? And then how can ARC readers become your ARC readers? What do you think on that?
So what I think of as being the difference between beta and ARC readers, I think of beta readers as being inward facing and ARC readers as being outward facing. And so with Where Darkness Bloomed, I didn't use beta readers. It was just me for 2 years kind of reworking the story until honestly, by the time I published it, I was sick of it. So, and that was because the fatigue is so real. I mean, once you've read something 100 times. So
yeah,
you're just completely over it. And you don't know if it's good anymore. And so with book two, I had 3 people that I became just close friends with as I was publishing book one. These were people that just kind of came around the book, came around the story, loved it, and just became part of my circle. And I'll just am forever grateful for their support. And they gave incredible feedback for book one, really, really thoughtful sort of critique for it. And so those, I chose 3 individuals and just asked, would you be interested in being a beta reader? Because you're this trusted person for me. We have similar taste in kind of sort of the sweeping mythic scope that I'm trying to write. And I really trust your eye for that. And like Rebecca said, is that it's more of trying to figure out, is this hitting the way I'm wanting it to hit? Because at this point, I'm on draft 7, and it's 600 pages. So it's taken me, you know, a month and a half to get through line by line the whole edit. And it, by the time you spend a month and a half reading anything, your eye is shot. You can't see the forest for the trees anymore. And so when I finished this edit, I had just said, you know, it's going to be hitting your inbox Monday. I'm going to have some points. I'm going to provide a form that basically shows the points that I'm shaky on. I'll give an example. So book two is a retelling of the Odyssey, which is this really large sweeping tale, and it requires a lot of flashback. So the reader has full context. Because it requires a lot of flashback, you don't want to just, you know, dump it in there. You want to make sure that you're massaging it right, that you're weaving it into the storyline. And so one of the things that I'm asking them to provide feedback is the level of flashback that I'm using. Is it too much? Is it too heavy at points? Are we hitting the right beat? You know, all of that. And then like Rebecca said, ARC readers, I think of those as being outward facing. Their feedback is not so much for me as it is for the readers who are going to potentially buy it after Pub Day. It's kind of the first yay or nay that's public because, you know, beta reader feedback is not going to be public. It'll just be for me so I can keep working on the points that need to be worked on. And so as far as ARC reading for me, what I did for book one was I had been posting about it online and just trying to build a platform because I didn't have a platform before last, May? I started my Booksta account in May. And so just posting about it and seeing what kind of interest level there was, trying to make sure readers knew kind of what to expect if they signed up. And then I just posted it and then asked the people who I had built a network with to share it among people that they felt like the story would resonate with. And their response was fantastic. And then I also used a marketing firm to help me manage it just because I didn't have a social media presence and I wanted a wide reach. And so I used the Nerd Fam to do an all call for ARC readers. And that was incredibly helpful. And they ultimately were the ones who sent the book out because I was just like, I'm not confident in my ability to do any of this correctly. So they, you know, they were really helpful in doing that.
That's amazing. I recently discovered the Nerd Fam. And so there's a couple different, I guess, businesses or companies that do that, right? So you reach out as an indie author and you do like a campaign, right? Where you pay and then they like send your book out to other influencers and other people like in the market, in like the bookish market. Is that correct? Or how does that all break down?
Different marketing firms offer different services. What you're talking about sounds like a tour. So like a social media tour where different influencers get a copy of your book and they showcase it with the, you know, the blurb or the synopsis or to kind of showcase the book. And it's usually something that's beautiful and aesthetic. So they do offer book tours as well. I did one back in, I think, September. What the Nerd Fam did for me specifically with regard to ARC readers, though, is they essentially improve your reach. So I don't know anything about how to manage an ARC list. I don't know anything about how it's supposed to happen. I'm new here. And so they release a catalog monthly and say, hey, readers that follow us, these are the books that are coming up that we could potentially do an ARC for. And so sign up, you know, if you're interested in reading. And then they provide an enormous Excel sheet to the author and basically say, here's all the people who have signed up. How many do you want to go out? Are there any physical copies that you want to go out, or do you want to do it all e-ARCs? And different authors choose different, you know, methods. And then the Nerd Fam either sends the book out to them, or if you want to do it yourself, you can. I did not want to do it myself. And so that's kind of the ARC service they provide. And for someone who's very new to the industry and just has no idea what's going on, it was incredibly helpful to me just because I didn't really know how it worked even then.
Yeah, I didn't know that you had like different choices as you're going through like that marketing firm. Mm-hmm. That's very interesting. So Christopher, tell me about what your journey was with Maximus and ARC readers, and did you have beta readers?
So with Maximus, I raw dogged it, guys. I just straight up cold released it. I wrote Maximus for myself, for my friends. It's a really like close to heart story that I wrote as a coping mechanism when my best friend passed away. So the found family trope's like super hardcore, and the characters are very close to home, and that's why that story pops out so prominently to readers, that trope, I mean. But so I cold released it. I was actually going to be published by HarperCollins back in 2012. And I won a contest called Autonomy. I don't remember if you guys knew what Autonomy was. But no, it was a platform hosted by HarperCollins. And you would submit like daily, and you would have people review your books. It's kind of like Wattpad, but like really more competitive and more exclusive. And I won that. I messed up that deal, because I wasn't good at following directions, and they wanted me to change my book a lot, take out a lot of different things, change my characters, change my names, remove references that I wrote towards other books. And it started to look unrecognizable. So I dropped it and just started focusing more on my real career. So when I decided to release Maximus, I come from the medical device world, and the company that I was working for was closing down, like going bankrupt. And I was like, I got a lot of time on my hands. So I got a job where I was practicing 3 days a week orthodontics, and the other 2 days a week, I was like, what am I gonna do? And during my other free time, I started writing again. And I was like, you know what? I'm gonna finish Maximus, you know, my way. And I'm just gonna put it out there. Why not? And I did. Yeah. And I cold turkeyed it. And it did okay. You know, I got 4 or 5 star reviews. I was pretty happy with it. I was like, okay, I'm a writer now. I'm gonna start writing. So I started writing other books. And I went back and I read it again. And I was like, oh no, what did I do, guys? So one of the best parts about being an indie author is nobody can tell you what to do. So I was like, hey, it's already out. I'm going to release it as a special edition, and I'm just going to re-edit the whole thing. I added 200 pages. I rewrote maybe like 7 chapters, and I got a publishing assistant. Her name's Gigi. She's a fantastic woman. And Gigi helped me come up with a proper ARC team, proper beta team. And I recently re-released it in September. And I treat it now like the way that I treat releasing a new product, which is kind of weird. But there's alpha, beta, and pilot. And so the alpha is like you're creating the product, or I'm writing the book that's for me. And then beta is your test group of like 3 to 5 really trusted, like close, well-known providers, or in our sense, like readers, that are going to give you honest feedback, constructive criticism, that is going to help you understand like what are the strong parts of your book, what are the weak parts of your book, where are there plot holes, where are there areas your characters could develop, where did you miss. And it gives you a chance to take that and start upgrading your product or my book to make it ready for the consumer, which is our pilot group. And when you're done with that edit, and you know, you don't want too many cooks in the kitchen, like Katie was saying, like 5 people is like solid, dude. And you don't really want to go past that, because then it's going to start influencing your actual book and it might not be recognizable. So you want to keep it to like the main source. And so that's what I do. I have like no more than 5 beta readers right now. I'm beta reading Soundweaver, which is a book about music and magic that I'm writing. It's like my Percy Jackson meets Hogwarts meets Break Bills meets Avatar. It's pretty fun. The Last Airbender, not the blue guys.
Oh, I was like, wow.
They took that name after it was already out there. So you do that, and you put out your ARC copy, and your ARC copy for me is my pilot. And I'm like, this is the product that I think is ready to go to market, but you still have a little bit of a window because you give it to them early enough that if they do give you feedback that's constructive or useful, and you clean that up, that way when you go to actual market, it is good to go. It is the best your product could possibly be, the best your book could possibly be, and you can hit the market, you know, running. I was writing notes on this the other day, and I wrote down something that I thought was really important, and it's simple. A release is nothing without a strong art team or street team. You're relying on them for your early reviews, your marketing material that you're going to use to help boost your book for release day, and they're everything. So I always want to make sure that like I'm giving my street team a good shout out. My street team is amazing. Thank you, the elites. You guys, I love you guys. I would be nothing without you. My release would have been nothing without you guys. And I'm forever grateful. Just the quotes they pull out for you. Some of them annotate your books for you. And they're finding things that like you didn't think were special. And now you're like, what I wrote really hit home. Okay, I'm going to use that. I'm going to show that.
Love that. Yeah, thank you all for sharing. I have a follow-up question that I didn't think about. So you have ARC readers, right, which is like a bigger batch of people. And then you have what you said is a street team. What is the difference between that? Is it just a smaller group of people that you personally reached out to? Or did you like have an application to become part of the street team? Or what qualifications do you have to be part of a street team?
So my street team is essentially where I pull my beta and ARC readers from. I have an application for a street team, and those people I add to my group, and then I pull for them for all of my books. And they're constantly there as a support group, like Lady Gaga and her little monsters. We celebrate each other's birthdays. I do like a monthly like giveaway just because like I want to keep them all excited. And they send me cool ideas. They're like, hey, you should do a recipe on this one. Because like I also have a cocktail book and a cookbook that are associated with my novels. And they're like, yeah, you should make the espresso martini. It's the holiday. And I'm like, all right, girls, you got it. Or they're like, hey, can you make me a dinger? So I did a dinger recently for Evie's episode. Evelyn, she did a podcast with Katie a little bit ago, right?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, Evelyn's dope. I love Evelyn.
She's great. She's the best.
And yeah, that's my version. So what do you ladies think? What do you consider a street team?
Yeah, that's a good question. Katie, we'll go ahead and start with you. So do you have a street team, and how did you choose your street team?
I do. Street team, Christopher was saying, it's basically a hype squad. And so the way I did it was with book one, I didn't use beta readers. The Nerd Fam kind of cast the wide net for ARC readers. Mm-hmm. But I did do an application for a street team. And I almost missed the boat on that because I had never even heard of that before, because I wasn't in, you know, I wasn't really in the bookish community. I was just writing. So that kind of was part of the learning curve with social media and learning to market yourself. And so I was seeing people talking about their street teams and was just like, I don't really know what that is, but they are clearly getting the word out on these books. And so just through talking to other friends and including Evelyn and just meeting people, a few people had asked, if you have a street team, I'd love to be on it. When are you dropping the application? And I was like, I need to get an application for a street team. They're just book reading angels who just love to hype indie authors. And so I'm in, you know, group messages with a ton of my street team members. They've been amazing the last 3 months. They're still posting about it. They're still checking in for updates on book two. They're just amazing. I've gotten to celebrate milestones with them whenever I reached, you know, goals that I had for sales and you know, surpassed them. I got to celebrate when the book signed with the literary agent because it was purely through the fact that these wonderful people took the time and effort at not being paid for it at all. And I'm just going to hype this book because I love it. And I've made a friend, you know, in KD. And so that was kind of my experience with street team. Some of my favorite people are on my street team. So yeah, they're amazing.
That is incredible. Rebecca, do you have a street team? And how did you choose your street team?
I do. So kind of like similar to what they've both said. So my street team is composed of a lot of actually ARC readers. I kind of went about it the opposite way. At first I was like just looking for ARC readers, brand new at this last year. Didn't really know what I was doing. So I built an ARC team and then I built another ARC team for the second. And I started thinking like, I really should just have like a permanent like street team that I can build and then pull from for the different ARC applications or ALC. And so I opened up, I call it my influencer team. Anybody can join it. I'm pretty open to it actually. So anybody who wants to join my influencer team can. The link is in all of my bios via the link tree. And once you're a part of it, you get like first access and first dibs, if you will, to any ARCs or ALCs and that kind of thing. And you can also join. I have like a big chat on Instagram with a bunch of them. Super fun getting to like share different videos or reels or updates, back and forth, that kind of thing. It's just special. And they also get like emails with news beforehand. So like I just released a novella. Originally, I was actually just writing it for my street team. I just wanted to give them a thank you for everything. And so I was like, it's going to be a short story. And then it grew into this novella. And I was like, well, okay. So, but they all got it and it's free. You know, I wanted it to be a gift. And so I gave it to them all before everyone else got it. And it's still free for everyone. I do like the raffle idea. I like that idea a lot. So I'm going to take you up on that, Christopher. I'm going to like steal that idea. But thanks. Yeah, I love my street team. They're the greatest. So.
Yay. Shout out to all the street teams. So you don't have to, like, to be part of a street team, you don't have to have a big following or be a big influencer. You just have to be passionate about the book that the author is writing. Reach out, right? Hey, I want to be part of your street team. So anybody, if you are good online, if you are good at hyping and cheering people on, then maybe a street team is for you, for our listeners.
Yeah.
That's incredible. I love getting some more, like, inside scoop on how to be an ARC reader. I was like, I love reading. I want to be an ARC reader. I want to read books before they're out and, like, say if I like them or not, and then, like, help hype people up. And then I was like, am I good enough to read this book that isn't even on the market yet, right? Everyone, all the authors are just normal people. Just people doing things every day and writing. And being an ARC reader doesn't have to be so scary. You just keep a lookout and sign up when you see it.
You are good enough. We want you. Join our street teams.
The Goodish Girls Pod supports you. Yes, that's incredible. So I want to kind of switch gears a little bit, and I want to talk about what it's like to write a male character versus a female character, because each one of your books are obviously different from each other, but they're also written in different, like, POVs, essentially, right? What is it like, and how do you go about writing characters from the male versus female perspective? Katie, we'll start with you this time.
Sure. So my books are written from, like I already said, a close third. Mm-hmm. The way that reads is Persephone did this, but then a close third also gives you a look into her thoughts and her stream, a limited stream of consciousness from that character. So again, the best examples I have of that would be Throne of Glass. It's written from close third.
Right.
I think my characters are more motivation driven, and a gender certainly plays a role in that, just because a character like Persephone is not going to approach a circumstance the same way as a strong, you know, mythic male like Hades. And so I think one of the things that I wanted to make sure of the most in writing the female characters in my book, especially, you know, Persephone and Helen, these women go through periods of captivity and periods of wrestling with weighty things like guilt and, you know, survivor's guilt and what's occurring before them. And so to me, with a female character, one of the most important things you can do is make sure that you're writing agency. So she's not just this little doe-eyed thing wandering around life. Otherwise it reads incredibly flat and just almost saccharine, like sickly sweet. I know everyone has read a female character where you're like, ugh, girl, you know, do something. And so I think agency is what makes those incredibly powerful heroines. They're actually doing something and mm-hmm. seeking to affect change in meaningful ways. I think nothing pairs better with that than a strong male. So that is a lot of what you'll see in my books, just because that is what I enjoy writing and that's what I enjoy reading as a reader.
Did you find it harder to write thoughts from Hades rather than thoughts from Persephone?
Flowed a lot easier from Hades than it did Persephone. I think it was because in the myth itself, Persephone, she's this innocent person. Her name at the beginning of the story is Kore. So that's the same in Greek mythology. She was also called Kore, which means maiden. So she's essentially innocence personified, which can kind of lean into that saccharine, sickly sweet feeling. And her arc took a lot of writing and a lot of rewriting, just because you want the rise to be credible. You want it to read correctly. And so I found it actually much more difficult to write her than I did him. He's just kind of this strong masculine figure, and he has his own arc too, but it's not quite as dramatic as her. That's part of her myth, is that she's innocent. And then she becomes a queen in her own right. And so it is just a full-blown 180 almost.
That's very interesting. I really thought you were going to say the opposite.
Nope.
Wow. Okay. All right. Christopher, I throw the question to you then, because you have written Evie, right, which is your female character, then you have Kristoff. So was it difficult to write from, like, Evie's perspective?
No.
Or did that flow pretty naturally?
So I wrote my characters based off people I know and people I love, and that's why I know them so well. I also do this crazy weird exercise my friend Ray Muniz calls, like, the character interview. And yeah, I interview them. I do everything from, like, the basic stats, like their appearance, their background, where they're born, what's their home life. But then I go into it, I'm like, all right, what are their likes? What are their dislikes? What are their hobbies? What are their nicknames? What are their favorite books? What are their favorite movies? What are their favorite dishes? What restaurants like to go to? Where do they like to hang out? So when it comes to like writing my story, they kind of like become a true friend to me. So I can start to like speak to them as someone that I know. So Evie happened to actually be based off of someone that I grew up with. I do that for all of my characters. So just going on to Michael, because Michael's about archangels in heaven. It was a lot more difficult for me to kind of like figure out who my characters were. I had to really rely on my character interview to get to know who these characters were. That made it easier for me to write them. And that's what works for me.
What a unique way to go about that. That's incredible. So for anyone like listening or watching this, if you're looking to be an indie author, maybe that is a way that you can go about, is you can treat it as if you're talking to a real person, right? As you're writing and developing your character. That's really cool. I like that. So Ms. Rebecca, what do you think on that?
I think the hard part for me wasn't so much the different like male versus female or the gender aspect with it, because, you know, Chance has his own point of view. Tate has her own point of view. In book two, Aether gets his own point of view. So it wasn't so hard in that element. I think more than anything, it was keeping their voices unique. And so that's, I think, where it would be, because I did write it first person, because it is so up close, because you get constant streams of consciousness to where it's like, even the way that what you're witnessing it completely through their eyes. And so it's their truth. It's a fragment of the story. It's a part of the story, but it's not the entire whole story. And so I think with that in mind, there'd be times where I would write, especially dialogue, I would write something about, no, that doesn't sound like him. And I'd delete it and then like redo it. And so I think that was maybe the challenging part. But as far as like connecting with each of my characters, that I didn't have any trouble with, because I think, at least for me, I put bits of myself into every character. And yes, I have characters that are inspired by, like, I have Shay, and she's inspired by my sister. And, you know, I have these different characters who do find inspiration in real life. And sometimes it's very cathartic for me, right? Sometimes I'm putting a character that's maybe a little bit more difficult to write because of things I've been through, and putting it into that character. And a lot of times when I'm writing it, I feel like I am documenting a scene I see in my head, especially for fantasy, because everything in there is unique to that world. And yes, it is fueled by me, obviously, but a lot of times I just kind of almost approach it like I'm a scribe. And I don't really have any issues with male versus female in that sense, because I'm just so closely connected to each character.
Wow. I feel like every time I do one of these episodes, I learn so much about what goes on behind the keyboard. I love that each one of you literally creates these characters and put your own thought and feelings and heart into them to make them who they are. So that's amazing. Well, I have some final questions. Each one of you is getting an individual question. So Rebecca, we'll start with you. If you could give a new, brand new indie author one piece of advice, what would you give them? What would you say?
I mean, I would say just don't be hard on yourself and don't compare yourself and just go for it. It's really hard starting off. It's hard finding your footing. We all have our own unique journeys. We all choose whether we want to go self-publish or traditional or a hybrid approach. We all build our art teams and street teams in our own way. We all offer own rewards or do book mail or don't do book mail, and tell the stories that we want to tell. And that's the beautiful part. Like Christopher was saying earlier, like when you are indie, you get to tell the story completely and wholly how you want to tell it. You're the one who determines that. And so it's the same thing with your journey. No two journeys are the same. No two stories are the same. And so ultimately, I'd say just like give yourself lots of grace, celebrate each and every small victory, because they do add up. Every book sale, even if it's just two a month, like that is still two more people who decided to take a chance on you and on your story and on your characters. Just take every small moment for what it's worth and embrace your journey for what it is.
Amazing. I like that advice. So KD, I have a question for you. What is one mistake that you made as an indie author that you would like to express so that way other indie authors maybe can avoid that, we're like posting the wrong chapter in the wrong place or something that happened in your journey to it that you're like, man, I hope no one else does this.
Sure. I think I put, especially in the final stretch, I put way too much focus on it being perfect. I could not figure out how to stop editing to the point that, I mean, even last, so the book published September 16th, in June and July, I had so much pressure on myself that this has got to just be perfect. Yeah. And so I remember my husband just very kindly being like, hey, like you're kind of obsessing over this a little bit, don't you think? And I was like, yeah, I'm obsessing over it. You know, I'm just completely obsessing over it. So I should have cut off editing about 3 iterations before I did. And the only thing I did at that point was add more pressure to myself. You've written what you've written. And it's not going to be perfect, but it's going to be something better because it's going to be yours. Yeah. Every single word is not going to be perfect. You could edit from now till the kingdom comes. And you're probably still going to find things you could change. I had scenes that are still in the book that I called my sticky scenes where I just could never get them perfect. But, you know, finished is better than perfect, and perfect just doesn't exist. And so you kind of have to let go of that, because it'll kind of lock you down in chains if you let it. And overwhelmingly, that's a self-imposed standard. That would be my biggest mistake, was just letting all that pressure over things that just did not substantively matter to the book really kind of clamp down the last couple months.
I mean, we are our own worst enemy.
Yeah.
Right? You're in your own brain.
In that case, I was.
Yeah, and I can only imagine that made the release like harder and maybe a little bit less enjoyable than it could have been, right?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Because it's just more pressure. I think it's kind of like sculptors. If you're sculpting a statue, you probably notice every single little nick and flaw. Somebody else is looking at it and saying, man, that's beautiful. You know, you're your harshest critic. And, you know, again, your book is not going to be perfect, but it's better than perfect because it's yours.
And even the biggest authors make mistakes, right? And
They still
move on with life and do what they need to do, and they still keep writing. So if they can do it, you can absolutely do that as well. So Christopher, final question. I know that you said that you have another book coming out. What is next for you as an indie author?
What's next for me? So I have 4 books coming out. There is The Elites, which is book 2 for Michael. There is Eros, the special edition, which is the sequel to Maximus. I actually removed Eros from the history of the internet. So I'm actually rewriting the entire book because I felt like there was too many plot holes after writing Michael. Then there's Soundweaver, which is Manhattan Arcanum.
Oh, that's a cool shirt.
Hey.
Thank you. Very nice.
Yeah, I make all my own merch. Soundweaver is going to be my 9th symphony. It's going to be my biggest and best. I'm going to try to go traditional for that one. So it's going to be a little while before that comes out, but I will be getting some more readers for it. If you want to join my street team, maybe you'll get a sneak peek.
You get a sneak peek, make it a shirt, some merch. Yes, absolutely. Yeah,
absolutely. My street team is well clothed.
I love that. Before we say goodbye, I would like to hear one of your favorite quotes from your book. So Christopher, we'll start with you. Do you have a favorite quote for us you would like to share?
I do. It's from the bookstore owner in my book, Ray. And he says, a word of advice. If a guy offers to buy you a book, take it. That guy knows how to treat a lady. Books are much better than flowers. She looked up at him confused. The words in a book are forever. The scent and beauty of a flower is only temporary. There one day, gone the next. And he winked it at her.
Amazing. I don't want flowers. I only want books. KD, do you have a favorite quote for us that you would like to share?
Mine would be, it's kind of towards the end of the book, but mine would be, it's the stars mean nothing to me, not when I've stood in the light of you. So that would be my favorite.
Oh.
I love that.
That's nice. That's a good one. Hades is one of my favorites. Hades can tell me anything, and I'm like, okay. So, Miss Rebecca, tell us one of your favorite lines. It's my favorite part.
I know. So this is hard, but I think what came to my mind initially is what I'm going to go with, and it is also towards the end of Fangs of Fate. It's kind of a good setup for book 2, and it happens between Aether and Tate, and he kind of looks at her, and he just says, there's no world where I exist and you don't. And I love that so much because I think it really captures a lot of this like fated mate dynamic they have, but it's also, they're very much like enemies to lovers throughout the book. And it's like during this final battle sequence, and there's a lot of meaning to it. And I just really love that line so much. It's one that a lot of my ARC team members and street team members have like highlighted and shared.
Yeah, it's beautiful. Will never ever get over a fated mate trope. It's my favorite. Thank you guys so much for joining us today on our second episode of Indie Talk. I hope for all of our listeners, if you are an indie author or you are thinking about becoming an indie author, that you stay tuned for more episodes that we have, because we are bringing on incredible people to tell us about their journey and hopefully help other authors as they are growing and learning as well. So thank you guys.
Save on quality sofas, sectionals, top brand mattresses, and more during Haverty's President's Day sale. Find the style of furniture you've been looking for at Haverty's, online or in Columbus at Polaris.
Here's golf legend John Daly.
Hell yeah, these wins are piling up faster than my divorces.
I only spent on Moto, America's social casino. You know I've won a couple of majors. And on Moto, I've won majors, grands, and epic jackpots on their classic Vegas slots with huge, huge bonus rounds. Moto Casino adds new games and awards players free coins every single day. Grip it and spin it on Moto Casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details.
Moto Casino, America's social casino.